Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Continuing our study of Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, in this Bhaktivedanta Module 1, Canto 7 to 9, and we are in 7th Canto, Chapter 2, text numbers 27, 36. So in these verses, initially there are not a lot of purports. So, now to summarise, it's always good to start with a summary. Helps you to develop your memory. So memory, like any other part of the body, is something where you exercise it and it becomes strong. And when you don't exercise it, it becomes weak. It has to be utilised. So previously we were discussing how Hiranyaksha was killed by Lord Varaha, and the relatives.
Sorry, probably didn't interrupt. I was told that you might have a key to the guest rooms because we've got some guests locked out.
Oh, okay.
Sorry,
everyone. Sorry,
interrupt.
So. The after the killing of Hiranyaksha, the older brother of Hiranyakashipu, naturally there was a lot of lamentation for his relatives, his wives, children. And Hiranyakashipu displayed his philosophical knowledge and began to describe to them that they should not lament for the material body because the living entity is the soul. And in this regard, he's now about to recite a Puranic scripture which describes Yamaraj discussing this philosophy. So not only is Hiranyakashipu correctly giving philosophy, but he's correctly quoting Shastra. And as we discussed previously, that it is very difficult sometimes to distinguish between demoniac religious persons and persons who are actually proper devotees of the Lord, because both can sometimes quote Shastra equally. Sometimes the non-devotees can quote Shastra even better than the devotees. Sometimes it appears that devotees have the bad qualities, and sometimes it appears that the non-devotees have the good qualities. So we have understood that in the ultimate issue, the discriminating factor is that whatever a non-devotee does or a demoniac person does, they are doing for their own self-aggrandizement, their own particular material goals. Whereas whatever a devotee does, he is doing in order to follow the instructions of the Lord and to please the Lord. We have an example of this with ISIS, who have just, you know, they declared their caliphate in Syria, that from that place they began a holy war by which they would conquer the whole world and destroy all the infidels. And that city of Mosul was there, you know, declared in the scriptures to be the place where this war would begin and end gloriously. Unfortunately for them, Mosul has been retaken by the opposition to ISIS, and as a parting gesture, then ISIS bombed the 800-year-old mosque there. The very mosque that they declared the holy war from, they bombed it and blew it to smithereens. So, as you can see, there they don't want that to fall into the hands. You know, if it's got no value to them, then it's not as if it's God's property. It's their property to destroy whatever. See? So when they finish with it, you know, in the beginning, now this is the holy place, holiest of the holiest. Now we have no need for it. There's a few of us left. We're surrounded. We've got to get out of here. It's all defeated. We have no... Let's bomb it. See? So in the long run, we see that they're not acting in the interest of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Persons who claim to be religious but who are in fact demoniac. So now, of course, another factor that we understood was that although they can quote Shastra sometimes correctly, not all the time, as Prabhupada mentions, even the philosophers and scientists of this day and age, really, Hiranyakashipu, who's a great demon, makes them look like fools and rascals, because they don't know any scripture. They don't know that they're not the body, that they're a spirit soul. But even when a demoniac person is, or a non-devotee, is quoting scripture with proper understanding of the soul, they cannot understand the personality of Godhead, because that can only be understood by bhakti, not by just citing scripture. And therefore we see that, you know, Hiranyakashipu has a materialistic mentality of Vishnu, or, you know, Krishna, the personality of Godhead, and feels that, you know, that is a material manifestation temporarily of the Supreme, who's impersonal Brahman. But if he can get rid of that material manifestation of Vishnu by destroying, you know, the foundation of that manifestation, the Brahmanas and religious principles, then the only one that's left, that will be him, and then he will be the supreme, like this. So there's a very materialistic understanding of God, so that they can't bluff, that part there. Although, you know, sometimes with descriptions of, they can quote Shastra, but actually understanding the personality of Godhead, they can't do. And they think they've understood scripture about God, but they will always misquote it and take the personality of God out of it because of their envious mentality and the materialistic, you know, take on the scriptures and spiritual life. So these are the different aspects that we've summarised previously in the previous discussions on this section. So now we're seeing that Hiranyakashipu is quoting Shastra, and he is giving this historical evidence. Now, Prabhupada, in the purport, again, we see that as an interesting thing in the first purport, text number 27, he says the Puranas are not chronologically recorded, but the incidents mentioned in the Puranas are actual histories of bygone ages. Srimad Bhagavatam is the Mahapurana, the essence of all the Puranas. The Mayavadi scholars do not accept the Puranas. But Srila Madhvacharya and all other authorities accept them as the authoritative histories of the world. So here we see that, there's a difference between the impersonalists, those who just have a materialistic understanding of the personality of Godhead, has a material form. It's very similar to the Mayavadis, but here at least Hiranyakashipu is accepting the Puranas, so he's an impersonalist. Not necessarily you would classify him as a Mayavadi. Mayavadis, again, they actually reject some scriptures in order to promote their philosophy of the Mayavad philosophy. So here we see that even Hiranyakashipu, not only is he above the scientists and the philosophers of this world, but he's also a step above the Mayavadis because he accepts the Puranas as well. So we'll read on. In the state known as Ushanara, there was a celebrated king named Suyogya. When the king was killed in the battle by his enemies, his kinsmen sat down around the dead body and began to lament the death of their friend. So he's citing a very similar scenario, almost exact to what is happening with Hiranyaksha and his family. His golden bejeweled armour smashed, his ornaments and garlands fallen from their places, his hair scattered and his eyes lustreless. The slain king lay on the battlefield, his entire body smeared with blood, his heart pierced by the arrows of the enemy. When he died, he had wanted to show his prowess, and thus he had bitten his lips, and his teeth remained in that position. His beautiful lotus-like face was now black and covered with dust from the battlefield. His arms, with his sword and other weapons, were cut and broken. When the queens of the king of Ushanara saw their husband lying in that position, they began crying, "O Lord, now that you have been killed, we also have been killed." Repeating these words again and again, they fell down, pounding their breasts at the feet of the dead king. So, Prabhupada begins to point out in his purport here, the theme of this chapter, that he'd bit his lips to show his prowess, but nonetheless he was killed by providence. We didn't know. This proves that we are controlled by higher authorities. Our personal power or endeavour is not always supreme. We must therefore accept the position offered to us by the order of the Supreme. As the queens loudly cried, their tears glided down their breasts, becoming reddened by kumkum powder, and fell upon the lotus feet of their husband. Their hair became disarrayed, their ornaments fell, and in a way that evoked sympathy from the hearts of others, the queens began lamenting their husband's death. O Lord, you have now been removed by cruel providence to a state beyond our sight. You had previously sustained the livelihood of the inhabitants of Ushanara, and thus they were happy. But your condition now is the cause of their unhappiness. O King, O hero, you were a very grateful husband and the most sincere friend of all of us. How shall we exist without you? O hero, wherever you are going, please direct us there so that we may follow in your footsteps and engage again in your service. Let us go along with you. So she wanted to enter into the funeral fire. System known as Saha Marana. The time was appropriate for the body to be burned, but the queens, not allowing it to be taken away, continued lamenting for the dead body, which they kept on their laps. In the meantime, the sun completed its movements for setting in the west. So according to the Vedic system, if a person dies during the daytime, it is customary for his funeral ceremony to be performed before the sun sets, regardless of whether he is burned or buried. And if he dies at night, the funeral must be completed before the next sunrise. Apparently the queens continued lamenting for the dead body, the lump of matter, and would not allow it to be taken away for burning. This illustrates the strong grip of illusion among foolish persons who consider the body the self. Women are generally considered less intelligent. Because of ignorance only, the queen thought of the dead body as their husband, and somehow or other thought that if the body were kept, their husband would remain with them. Such a conception of the self is certainly for Gokara, cows and asses. So here, you know, Prabhupada mentions women are generally less intelligent. And we see here in this example, you know, he's referring to the principle that sometimes, you know, the more emotional nature of women, the more sentimental nature of women, means that it can cover their good intelligence. And it is that, you know, nature, not a fault, but their nature, which sometimes it overshadows the intelligence. See? And when the intelligence is overshadowed, it's called less intelligent. So in that regard, but otherwise, you know, if women, if their intelligence does not become overshadowed by their... Yeah, up here. You jai. Yeah, he just fits nicely. Thank you. See how intelligently my wife has set up this beautiful altar and brought that in for us. This is spiritual intelligence. Yes, so just bear in mind that, you know, these things, these statements in the Bhagavad Gita should be taken in the proper context. I was hoping some of the women would be in the class when I read that, because I was going to get them to comment on that. But I had to do it for them. I've just offended Your Honour. Anyway, so we're into text number 35. Somewhere in the depths of this purport. Okay, so... so that bodily conception of life is there within the animals, the cows and the asses, for example. Prabhupada says, we've actually seen that sometimes when a cow's calf has died, the milkman cheats the cow by presenting before her the dead body of her calf. Thus the cow, who would not otherwise allow milking, licks the dead body of the calf and allows herself to be milked. So it's the same mentality. This substantiates the description of the sastra that a foolish man in the bodily conception of life is like a cow. Not only do foolish men and women consider the body the self, but we have even seen that the dead body of the so-called yogi was kept for days by his disciples, who thought that their guru was in samadhi. When decomposition began and a bad smell unfortunately began to overwhelm the yogic power, the disciples allowed the dead body of the so-called yogi to be burned. Thus, the bodily concept of life is extremely strong among foolish persons who are compared to cows and asses. So as we saw in the beginning of that purport, Prabhupada was describing how the women are generally considered less intelligent because they were lamenting for the dead body. As the purport goes on, Prabhupada describes that mentality, of course, is a mentality of animals, but anyone, whether they be woman, man, or even, you know, those who have disciples and, you know, of great knowledge, who have the same mentality, they're all less intelligent equally. They've all got the same intelligence as the cow or the ass. So, you know, this purport doesn't discriminate against women. But the statement of less intelligent is equally applied to anyone who allows their emotional state to overwhelm their good intelligence or their funded knowledge, and that is called a state of less intelligence. It is just that because, as we have discussed, that sometimes because women do have a more emotional feeling about the events, the circumstances of life, they may be more susceptible to that, and therefore that is the stigma that is there. But if an individual man or even a whole population of men have the same quality, they're on the same level. There's no distinction. And that level, when one becomes overwhelmed by the bodily conception of life and loses one's good intelligence, is actually the level no different from the cows and the and the asses.
Even Krishna also said to Arjuna, why this weakness has become, that's the weakness of the less intelligent.
That's right.
When you become overwhelmed by the fear to fight and compassion.
Yeah. And it quotes, in those sections of the Bhagavad Gita, that one should not quit this world like the cats and dogs with no knowledge of self-realization. So a similar verse is quoted. And the first statement of Krishna to Arjuna was that you're speaking like a learned person, the first real instruction you're speaking, but actually, but you're saying things that a fool would say. A less intelligent person, a person on the bodily conception of life, a person who's not much far above the animal platform of life. So yes, it is the same concept. So it's an interesting thing that this is a good retaliation for women. That sometimes, if in the shastras it says women are less intelligent, then when you catch out a man on the bodily platform of life, you're saying you're acting less intelligent. Because that is you're acting less than the women and the sudras and the cows. Nowadays, great scientists are trying to freeze dead bodies so that in the future those frozen bodies may again be brought to life. So I think Walt Disney, he was one of the persons who also had his body, something.
Frozen.
Cryo means freezing. The incident narrated by Hiranyakashipu from history must have taken place millions of years ago, because Hiranyakashipu lived millions of years ago and was even then quoting from history. Thus, the incident occurred before Hiranyakashipu's lifetime, but the same ignorance in the bodily concept of life is still prevalent, not only among laymen, but even among scientists who think they will be able to revive frozen corpses. Apparently the queens did not want to deliver the dead body for burning because they were afraid of dying with the dead body of their husband. So here again, you know, is an interesting concept with this term less intelligent. So we see that that term less intelligent is applied to anyone in that bodily concept of life where their emotions or their bodily concept of life has made their intelligence less, operating on a lower platform than it should. So it's less intelligent sort of thinking. And Prabhupada is applying that same status of less intelligent even to the greatest scientists and philosophers and, you know, socialists of this world. The exact same term that he applies to women, he applies to all the men of this world, even on the topmost level. So again, women shouldn't feel somewhat slighted, you know. And therefore, it's very difficult in Kali Yuga to really, you know, because everything is topsy-turvy, but you really have to go back to where there was a norm. Women were women, men were men, brahmanas were brahmanas, kshatriyas were kshatriyas, sudras were sudras, vaishyas were vaishyas, demons were demons, like that. Then you can see that there's actually a difference, significant. You know, now it's very topsy-turvy, so we have to be very careful of, you know, putting things in proper context to statements that apply in the Vedic concept and statements how they apply now. Like that. You know, so really, you know, a lot of proud men who come to ISKCON, I mean, over 40 years, you know, a lot of proud men have come to ISKCON and read something like that and taken it, you know, I'm so intelligent, all women less intelligent. And there's just real no context to it at all. All women, and every woman in the world, every man is more intelligent, you know. In ISKCON, devotees, preachers, senior preachers. So, you know, these things have to be considered very, very, very carefully. Text number 36. While the queens were lamenting for the dead body of the king, their loud cries were heard even from the abode of Yamaraj. Assuming the body of a boy, Yamaraj personally approached the relatives of the dead body and advised them as follows. Sometimes a living entity is forced to give up his body and enter another one according to the judgment of Yamaraj. It is difficult, however, for the conditioned soul to enter another body unless the present dead body is annihilated through cremation or some other means. The latest economical way is the water treatment. You see that? Yeah, by... they do a water process and dissolve it in water at a certain temperature, and it's considered far more cost effective and very quick.
Okay, can you say again what there is?
The latest method that they use.
No, that the Shastra, what it says in the Shastra,
until the body is annihilated through cremation or some other means. And it doesn't matter how it's annihilated, but it has to be gone. It could be eaten. It has to be annihilated. Annihilated.
Yeah,
that the soul cannot enter another body.
I actually read today, I don't know how I got there, it was speaking about near-death experiences in different shastras, like Talmud, Zohar, and
what, where were you reading from?
I think it was Hare Krishna in New Zealand. And they were talking about near death experiences of the devotees, and then on the bottom they had links to open different and actually it says that they could see that those bodies who were buried but not burned, they had to stay on the earth like bound, not couldn't go. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, just confirmation that they have it in other places.
Yeah. That's right. So, the living being has attachment for the present body and does not want to enter another. And thus, in the interim, he remains a ghost. If a living being who has already left his body has been pious, Yamaraj, just to give him relief, will give him another body. Since the living being in the body of the king had some attachment to his body, he was hovering as a ghost, and therefore Yamaraj, as a special consideration, approached the lamenting relatives to instruct them personally. Yamaraj approached them as a child because the child is not restricted but is granted admittance anywhere, even to the palace of a king. Besides this, the child was speaking philosophy. People are very much interested in hearing philosophy when it is spoken by a child. So,
I found that statement interesting because I thought, who would take a child seriously? But here,
well, it depends what they say.
They're saying that somebody said, well, what does this child know? I found that statement interesting.
Yeah, well, there's some statement in the Bible, isn't it? You know, from the mouth of babes, you know, some knowledge sometimes comes.
When I think of that statement, I think of the parents when their child starts talking and says, wow, that's so intelligent. And it's actually not intelligent if you could. I mean, for maybe small child, they're happy because they say, but now when they hear that the child speaks like this, they are, wow, this is, you know, we can't even figure out this, you know. So it draws attention. That's how I interpret it. Otherwise, Mataji, what she said, it's right.
Yes, but here he's actually speaking good philosophy, so that'll capture someone's attention. So just, you know, on this point, because that's why we do the Shraddha ceremony, because, you know, sometimes... as it was mentioned here, was a previous purport that you know, the if someone dies in the daytime, then generally they're cremated before sunset, or if they die at night, they're cremated before the sun rises. The Shraddha is performed on the 13th day, you know, generally. Someone once asked me, you know, why? I haven't seen any Shastric evidence, but, you know, I sort of was reflecting on, you know, the circumstances that of course, one, within that time they may become a ghost, and then, you know, there's the opportunity, so they'll get to experience that for some time, and then if the Shraddha is performed, then they'll be released from that. Otherwise, you see that from the time that they leave the body, Yamaraj is ready for making arrangements for the next destination of the soul. So now, from memory, I don't know if anyone can correct me, but you know, the time frame on Pitraloka was that the bright fortnight of the moon represents one day in Pitraloka, and the dark fortnight represents one night. Is that correct? Because I think on the moon planet, it was 6 months of the wax of the you know, of the year is one day, and 6 months of the, you know, the other 6 months of the year is. But on Pitraloka, it was a lesser time, And that would mean that basically, you know, within 13 days is almost one day in the abode of Yamaraj, your first day. Right? So, in other words, by the time a person is somewhat being presented, this is your activities, you know, these are the results of your previous lifetimes, and here is, you know, the destination that you may achieve, like this. And they may be given some indication as to where they're going to go, like that. But at that point, someone would perform the Shraddha, wouldn't they? You know, at that point. Almost like, you know, so they spent some time, it's all been sorted out, this is, and at that point someone performs the Shraddha and they're released from, you know, any, so they would understand that this is where I would have gone, but I was released. You know, that. So, anyway, I haven't seen Sastric, you know, reference, but from memory, that is the timing on Pitraloka, which is where Yamaraj resides. It all does happen very quickly, but, you know, once the soul leaves the body, if they're in the, you know, if they're doing things in Yamaraj's time, then that would be roughly the time frame compared to here.
Maybe it's also good to check in the third canto where, you know, when it says departure of the soul and the...
Yeah, I haven't seen any reference to the actual time.
There, so maybe there's some...
Yeah, we have reference in the fifth canto the time frame of different things. So, you know, and from memory that is the time frame of Pitraloka. And that tends to make sense because I always thought, gee, it's, you know, when I thought about it, it seems a long time, you know. The soul's like being gone for over a week, you know. Where who's looking after him, you know, like that. But actually, when you see it, that actually is a very short time in Yamaraj's time,
yeah.
Literally that day, you know, then it makes sense that they're really just making arrangements. And then someone performs the Shraddha, you know, and that person realizes, oh, now I've been delivered from this. So
so the Shraddha actually helps. It really helps. Yeah.
Well, that's what the Shastra says. The Shastra says this in the Bhagavad Gita Mahatmyam by Śrīla Gosvāmī, that at the time of the Shraddha, if there is a recitation of the Gita, then that ceremony is considered to be a success.
Not the traditional Shraddha.
No, this is, you know, these things must be there. There must be the offering of Vishnu Prasad. See, these days in India, they're just offering food and water. Sometimes offering Prasad, but sometimes it's food and water. There must be the recitation of the Gita and the Harinam Kirtan, and it must be done by a devotee.
That makes sense.
Then it works.
That makes sense. I think somewhere in Shastra it was written, you know how we have these rituals, on this day you offer rice bowl or something, and actually that's actually in the Shastra it says, in the it says actually the soul of that person eats, otherwise we'll be starving and being hungry.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, the little children, when they're watching, they're with, you know, the parents and the grandparents, and I'm doing a Shraddha, and they ask me, you know, how is the person eating that food? And I say to them that just as you may go to the bank and put $500 on the counter and say, I want to send this to my grandparent in India, and then they'll click some buttons, and then you may say, oh, the money's still there. And they say, no, your grandparent has received that exact amount where they are. See? So therefore, when we offer Maha Prasad, that's my understanding, is that where they are, they're actually eating Mahaprasad. And if they're eating Mahaprasad, that means devotees are serving it, because the devotees are the ones who offer Mahaprasad. And if devotees are there, they're hearing the Hare Krishna and they're hearing the Gita as well, just as we are doing. But even the benefit of what we are doing, that is also transferred to them.
And also said, if we don't offer Shraddha, if there is no one to offer Shraddha, the person will become Yamaduta.
Yeah.
For sure.
There's a variety of different things they can become. But, you know, for devotees, you know, the Shraddha is optional, you know, because...
So how does it work? Like you said, for devotees, it's optional.
That means that in the Bhagavad Gita, in the purport, you know, when Arjuna said to Krishna that, you know, if the, you know, previous generation is destroyed, culture is lost, religious performances will not be performed, the Shraddha will not be done, and the forefathers will fall down. And Prabhupada mentions there in the purport, in that section, that devotees, fully engaged in devotional service, by their devotional service, they automatically deliver hundreds and hundreds of generations, even if they don't perform the Shraddha. So for a devotee, it's not necessary, but we see that in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, Shraddha was performed by Advaita Acharya. He offered the Mahaprasad. Usually it's offered to the... That which is offered to the forefathers is then offered to the most elevated person. And Advaita Acharya offered it to Haridas Thakur. So he eats it. And that, you know, we saw Lord Chaitanya also perform the ceremony for his father. Krishna performed ceremonies for different personalities. So for devotees, it's optional. They don't have to. But still, a lot of the things that devotees do are optional. But it's sometimes better they do it, because all the relatives and friends who are watching will learn what to do if they don't happen to become devotees. If they don't happen to become devotees and they say, oh, well, you know, he's a very religious man, he didn't do it, then they may imitate that. So sometimes it's good that devotees show that example, even though they may not necessarily have to do it. Yeah. But there's no harm also for devotees, because when devotees do Shraddha, they're also just praying for Krishna to, you know, deliver that soul basically into the Sankirtan movement, you know. That's a special prayer that no one else is going to offer. So it's good that devotees will offer that prayer for their relatives.
And why just once a year? On the 13th day. Why not every day?
No, when a person dies, it's 13 days after they die. Every year you do it on the anniversary of the date that they died, by the tithi.
Then there's one day in the year which is said that, suppose if you have missed, for anybody you can do Shraddha on that day, or in that month.
That's right.
What is that?
Because sometimes you don't know when a person passed away. And if you don't know when they passed away, then there are dates that you can perform the Shraddha for all the departed souls that you may, you know, want to offer that benediction to. Yeah.
But my question is, why isn't it done every day? So, okay, we want to give it a departed soul.
Yeah.
Like for a devotee.
Yeah.
For them, they're offering and they're doing
devotion service.
They say, okay, we offer to
pastor. Because, you know, what happens, of course, is that the person who's performing the Shraddha. Sometimes people are performing the Shraddha so that people attain heavenly planets. And it's the merit of that Shraddha ceremony. As you know, to reside, say, on the moon planet or that sort of level, where every 6 months is one day and the next 6 months is one night, you know, so it means that they're residing in heaven as long as the pious merit from the Shraddha ceremonies, it keeps coming in. If it should run out, they fall from heaven.
No, not for saying the heavenly plan. It depends on what you're thinking. You can say that, okay, at least in the next lifetime they should take into devotional service.
Mm.
They should, just for that. Mm. Why can't you do it every day? Why only on that particular day they have that? We can pray that every day and offer the
boga to... Well, it's like putting the money in the bank, you know. You can only go there during the working hours when they're going to accept you. You know, it's like you can't turn up, you know. If you want to go to the bank, you can't bang on their
door.
But you
suppose the heavenly plan is that you can do after 6 months.
Everything, you know, they have their timings, you know. The demigod, just like Gayatri has said, you know, during the... certain times of the three junctures of the day. I mean, you can chant it in between that, but the person, the presiding deity who accepts it is not present. So you chant your Gayatri when she's present, you know, Gayatri Devi is present, she'll accept. Otherwise she might be, you know, off walking in the gardens of Nandanandana or something. It's like, you know, you don't accept a phone call every 2 minutes, you know, you just, you know, you'll accept a phone call when you're ready to accept it. You've tried calling me, I accept a phone call once a week.
My mom always, almost every day, chants, now I'm chanting this round for my cousin who passed away, this is for my father.
Yeah.
And she gives the benefit like that.
Yes, but Krishna is, you know, Krishna is omnipresent. Omnipotent, omnipotent. He's open for bhakti second by second. That, and we discussed that a couple of weeks ago. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjun says to Krishna that he is immeasurable and, what was the other one? Inexhaustible. Inexhaustible means that he can reciprocate with all of his devotees at every moment. He's inexhaustible. But the demigods are not inexhaustible. So you go to them when they're open for, you know, for what have you. But Krishna, bhakti, he's inexhaustible, but they're not. So, you know, there are time and a place for everything. So, Sri Yamaraj said, "Alas, how amazing it is, these persons who are older than me have full experience that hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth and died. Thus they should understand that they are apt to die, yet they are bewildered. The conditioned soul comes from an unknown place and returns after death to that same unknown place. There is no exception to this rule, which is conducted by material nature. Knowing this, why do they lament, uselessly lament?" Prabhupada quotes the Bhagavad Gita 2:28. That same philosophy is there. Unmanifest in the beginning, manifest in the interim, and unmanifest again when they're annihilated. What need is it for lamentation? Same philosophy. Now, so, you know, this is interesting because, you know, has anyone ever given a class on this, that slogan, that verse? It's, where's that Bhagavad Gita? 2:28. In the purport it says, accepting, well, Srila Prabhupada describes that, you know, there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in the existence of the soul. There is no cause of lamentation in either case. Now, here Prabhupada says, you know, taking for argument's sake the atheistic theory, still, there's no cause for lamentation. And he gives some examples of buildings being built and then being destroyed again. And then, of course, and if we accept the Vedic conclusion that the soul is eternal, even though the body is perishable, and then we must remember that the body is like a dress. So, here is a very good example of a common application for that particular verse. And that is, you know, the experience, as it says here, that this is experienced it says, persons who are older than me have fully experienced it. Hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth. So this is happening to everyone. There's no exception to this rule. This is happening to everyone. And this is a good application for that verse, if you're, you know, speaking, giving a class on that. How people, you know, see that someone has died and then they lament. But whether you're an atheist or believe in the soul, it's something that happens to everyone. It's just the way of material nature. It's quite strange, isn't it? You know, that something that's happens continually, repeatedly, for millions of years, everyone knows it was happened, and then as soon as it happens, it's like, oh, there's such a shock. You know, our family's gone through this terrible tragedy. You know, it's like, you know, we're somehow being singled out by bad luck. Actually, there's no need for lamentation. It's just it's an ongoing process. You know, it happens to all of us. And when it happens, oh, how could this have happened? It was so sudden. It just come out of nowhere like that. So, yeah, this is this little boy stating that. It's just the nature. Whether you believe in spirituality or, you know, you don't believe in the soul, it's the same. You would still question why people are lamenting. And Prabhupada mentions, he starts off his purport with the same statement he makes in the Bhagavad Gita, that accepting that there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in its existence, there is no cause for lamentation in either case. That's the exact same statement in the Bhagavad Gita. So, he gives some similar, he gives the same example. In fact, if you go through that purport, it's pretty much the same as the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada has, you know, because it is the same statement.
It's Prabhupada doing copy and paste or something.
Cut and paste. Prabhupada style. Yeah. Yeah, right, even the second, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right through, isn't it? You know, and it's just where you get to this section here in the Mahabharata, it is said. Yeah. And of course, you know, this is what you know, those who study Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Shastri should be able to do. You know, if you read something from the Gita, you know, you say, you know, yes, there's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam which states the same thing, and it goes like this. Or you read this verse and you go, yes, there's a verse in the back. You can cross-reference. You should be able to cross-reference in quite easily. So then it describes in the Mahabharata, it is said, and this statement could support the theory of the atheistic scientists that the child in the womb of the mother has no life but is simply a lump of matter. Even, I think they have a lot of debates in Christianity as well, and I think originally, you know, the Pope used to say that, you know, abortion was, you know, not permitted. And then because everyone wanted abortion, they said, well, you know, there's no soul in the, until 3 months. You know, and I think that's what they accept now. And I think if more people, you know, want abortion, then they'll push it forward. There's no soul to the, you know, the day before the child's born. You got 1 day left to make a decision. No, child will be gone by that stage. So anyway, to follow this theory, so it's interesting though, isn't it, that how, you know, when religious people want to accept something from a scientist when they don't want to, according to what satisfies their... To follow this theory, if the lump of matter is aborted by a surgical operation, no life is killed, the body of a child is like a tumour. And if a tumour is operated upon and thrown away, no sin is involved. And even the Christians have the same philosophy. Up until 3 months, there's no... Yeah, nothing was killed. No soul was, you know, done away with. The same argument could be put forward in regard to the king and his queens. The body of the king was manifested from an unmanifested source, and it again became unmanifested from manifestation. Since the manifestation exists only in the middle between the 2 points of unmanifestation, why should one cry for the body manifested in the interim? It's interesting. So, you know, very, you know, good preaching by Prabhupada. They're catching them out in their own philosophy. So you say that, you know, the child within the womb is, you know, is just a growth. At this stage, you know, it's just cut it out, you know, same as cutting. Then apply the same, you know. Apply the same to any human. Apply it to yourself. Why don't we just kill you? Being anti-abortion. So it's a very dangerous philosophy, and if they become subject to their own philosophy, it becomes a very dangerous world, doesn't it? And it is a very dangerous world because, you know, according to this philosophy, then, you know, wars and violence become not so much a sin, but, you know, a necessity, like removing a tumour or something, you know, and not a lamentable situation, nor a sacred situation that's being, you know, defiled. So the world is becoming subjected to its own materialistic philosophy. So, and that's the brilliance of Krishna's preaching in the Bhagavad Gita, that whether you're an atheist or whether you believe in the soul, there's no need for lamentation, either way you look at it. So why do the materialists, you know, give 100, you know, gun salute in some circumstances and do away with another one when they feel like it? You know, oh, this so-and-so died, there must be, you know, mourning for a month, and, you know, worldwide, you know, big, you know, ceremony in a golden cup, and this baby, you know. No, either way, if there's no lamentation, then apply it across the board. So obviously it points out that there's a cheating mentality or foolishness. There's either foolishness or cheating mentality. It is wonderful that these elderly women do not have a higher sense of life than we do. Indeed, we are most fortunate, for although we are children, we have been left to struggle in material life, unprotected by father and mother, and although we are very weak, we have not been vanquished or eaten by ferocious animals. Thus, we have firm belief that the personality of Godhead, who has given us protection even in the womb of the mother, will protect us everywhere. So here, you know, the boy is speaking that the actual fact that things are going on by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord. When it's time for the soul to leave, then that is arranged with the Lord. And when, if the soul is meant to stay, then he is immovable. So in the Bhagavad Gita, stated one of the qualities of the soul is immovable. Now, you know, until the Lord's ready, you cannot get the soul out of the body. You can't, you know, operate. You can't do anything. You know, until the Lord's ready, you can't remove that soul. He's immovable. And the soul within the body, he might decide, oh, how did I end up in this body? It's too big, it's too fat, it's too small, it's too ugly, too hairy, whatever. I want to get out. He can't get out either. You know, there are people who have tried to commit suicide 20, 30 times and they can't kill themselves. I've met someone like that. So, the arrangement of the Lord is, you know, there. So it's not a lamentable situation. And he's giving the example that, you know, here's this young child, the soul should have left, wandering around. How come some animal hasn't eaten me? And here's these adults, they're stronger than I am. Why has this one left his body? So he addresses the women again. O weak women, only by the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is never diminished, is the entire world created, maintained, and again annihilated. This is the verdict of the Vedic knowledge. This material creation, consisting of the moving and non-moving, is exactly like his plaything. Being the Supreme Lord, he is completely competent to destroy and protect. Prabhupada offers this argument. When Prabhupada offers, you know, an argument, it's the argument that, or the question that should pop into our head, but if it didn't, he's putting it there for us. If our husband was protected by the personality of God in the womb, why is he not being given protection now? To this question, the answer is, one cannot argue with the activities of the personality of Godhead. The Lord is always free, and therefore he can protect and he can also annihilate. He is not our order carrier. Whatever he likes, he will do. Therefore he is the Supreme Lord. So he can do this because he is supreme. No one can question his activities. If one argues, what is the purpose of this sinful creation annihilation? The answer is that to prove his omnipotence, he can do anything and no one can question him. So that's it. Why has he set up the material world like this? It's created and annihilated to prove his omnipotence. He can do anything. You cannot question him. Because, you know, when everything becomes annihilated, one thinks, stop that. No. I'm supreme. You cannot. If he were answerable to us concerning why he does something and why he does not, his supremacy would be curtailed. Now he says, the next verse, sometimes one loses his money on a public street where everyone can see it, and yet his money is protected by destiny and not seen by others. Thus the man who lost it gets it back. On the other hand, if the Lord does not give protection, even money maintained very securely at home is lost. If the Supreme Lord gives one protection, even though one has no protector and is in the jungle, one remains alive, whereas a person well protected at home by relatives and others sometimes dies, no one being able to protect him. And of course, you know that book, by Rudyard Kipling, The Jungle Book, Mowgli in the forest. He was left there and brought up by, you know, the animals, based on that principle. And so, you know, so these are examples he's giving to prove his case. The example of the money on the street reminds me of an incident when I was in Bali. I went over there in the 90s, and when I went to Bali, I went with I emptied out all my suitcase because I knew I'd buy some clothes and things over there. But I took a lot of things that I thought they wouldn't have, like, you know, woolen jumpers and things like that. And and when we went there, we sort of gave them in charity to people. So, but so, you know, as you're walking down the streets, you see a lot of beggars and things like that. There was, they have these beggars, but they're professional. I remember one lady come up to me, literally breastfeeding, standing in the street, breastfeeding a child as she's talking to me, looking like, you know, basically she's barely got the clothes on her back and, you know, the hungry baby and the whole thing, oh, you know. And I thought, no, you know, I know what, you know, a lot of the beggars, you know, it's a profession for them. And actually I saw that, I said no, and then, you know, I saw her later, she walked around a lane and there was a man there counting up the money that she was bringing him, and he had just wads and wads of it, you know, massive amounts of money, so she was just raking in the bucks, you know, for someone else who was using her as a profession. Anyway, there was some, and then some people sell things, watches and this, that and the other. Some of the ones from Java, they tend to be real pushy and even get violent if you didn't buy something. And so I wouldn't buy anything from them. One time, you know, someone, these people, they were sort of, they're poor, they're making out, they had to sell something to make a dollar. And I wasn't going to, you know, buy anything. And they kept following me up the street. And they followed me for, you know, probably about 50 yards, and I just kept saying, no, 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 you buy this watch, you pinky, or whatever like that, you know. Anyway, I got to a certain point, and they just stopped and walked away. And then I took one more step, and on the footpath was this great big wad of money. Yeah, that which I picked up, and then spent it. But there's no way to find it. It was not in Bali. But it was a difference of one step. You know, if I had taken one more step and be looking over my shoulder, I would have missed it, and he would have got it. So, but you know, it was really just one step in it. It was just destiny, whether I got it or he got it. That. So I consider that Krishna's reign. On the other thing about, you know, people being, you know, more equipped to protect themselves. When they had that fire I mentioned last week, you know, in England, and, you know, I don't know the exact number. They said it'd go up to 100. I know they got to about 60 or 70 or something. People died, you know, in the upper floors. The whole building burnt down. So, you know, on those floors, of course, you would have had some very intelligent people, some very strong people, some very wealthy people, a lot of security, a lot of fire things. They all died. And every one of them, the whole lot. Amongst them, there was a woman, a mother, and she had a baby, like literally, you know, not even a year old. From the 10th floor, she threw him out the window. And someone caught him, and he never got a scratch, nothing. So he survived without any ability to use intelligence, strength, money, or anything. You know, that's, you know, it just shows you that. it's not your own. You know, in the beginning we heard how the king, he died while biting his lip. You could see that in that battle or whatever, you know, he's like using all his prowess. None of that saved him. You know, and yet, you know, this is what this young boy is saying, that I'm a young boy, there's nothing, there's no prowess, and I'm alive and he's dead, you know. I don't. So proving the point that there is a higher authority, you know, there is providence. You can call it providence, but there is a higher authority which is above one's own abilities to maintain one's life. I read on, we're up to text number 41. Every conditioned soul receives a different type of body according to his work. We're up to 41. And when the arrangement is finished, the body is finished. Although the spirit soul is situated in subtle and gross material bodies, in different forms of life, he is not bound by them. For he is always understood to be completely different from the manifested body. Prabhupada giving the purport, what Yamaraj in the form of the boy is saying, that it's being plainly explained that God is not responsible for the living entities accepting different types of bodies. One has to accept a body according to the laws of nature and one's own karma. So, knowing that, you know, one can change. Just like in the Bhagavad Gita, there are five principles, four of them eternal, the Supreme Lord, the soul, material energy, time, but karma can be changed. And the fifth one. And therefore we see the Vedic injunction is that a person engaged in material activities should be given directions by which he can intelligently apply his activities to the service of the Lord to become free from material bondage of repeated birth and death. So karma can be changed. The Lord is always ready to give directions. Indeed, his directions are elaborately given in Bhagavad Gita. If we take advantage of these directions, then in spite of our being conditioned by the laws of material nature, we shall become free to attain our original constitutional position. Constitution. Without such surrender, one is obliged to accept a certain type of body according to his karma. Sometimes as an animal, demigod, and so on. Although the body is obtained and lost in due course of time, the spirit soul does not actually mix with the body, but is subjugated by the particular modes of nature with which he is sinfully associated. Spiritual education changes one's consciousness so that one simply carries out the orders of the Supreme Lord and becomes free from the influence of the modes of material nature. Text 42. Just as a householder, although different from the identity of his house, thinks his house to be identical with him, so the conditioned soul, due to ignorance, accepts the body to be himself, although the body is actually different from the soul. This body is obtained through a combination of portions of earth, water, fire. And when the earth, water and fire are transformed in course of time, the body is vanquished. The soul has nothing to do with this creation and dissolution of the body. So we see that the young boy, or Yamaraj, has first explained the futility of lamenting and now he's presenting the knowledge that within the body there is also the soul and the super soul. The super soul maintains the body, and the soul is there identifying with the body and subject to the karma. Prabhupada, you see here, Prabhupada says, the example given here is that a house or car is always different from the owner. But because of attachment, the conditioned soul thinks it to be identical with him. Prabhupada used the example of a car a lot because he knows that, you know, around the world, cars are like, well, they've replaced the cow and as the sacred object and the very heart of one's life. But people tend to identify with their car very much. They're very attached to their cars. Prabhupada knew that. So he's saying, you know, a car, a house. I remember one discussion, very humorous. Prabhupada was giving this example about, he was trying to explain to someone how he was not the body, but, you know, the body was like a vehicle and he was the driver, or, you know, of the body. And he gave the example of the car. And, you know, this conversation must have gone on for, you know, just about half an hour. So the person who was quite scholarly, I think he was English, but he couldn't even understand the example. You know, so Prabhupada was trying, at first, you know, so this makes perfect sense to us. So here Prabhupada used to get the, you know, big scholars and leaders to come in and he would talk to them. So this person struggled just to understand the example because he was so bereft of the concept that there was a difference between, you know, the soul and the body. The concept that there's something else except the body was so alien to him, he couldn't identify with the example. Right? And Prabhupada kept asking him, so, you know, what is the difference between the driver and the car? And he couldn't answer. And this conversation just, you know, went on and on and on. It's so humorous if you ever hear it. But it's a very simple example for us because we understand. But we have to realise that, you know, for a lot of materialists, they're so steeped in the concept, this is me. And even that example, they can't relate to the example, let alone how the analogy of relating it to the soul and the body. So he couldn't. This person could not relate to the fact that there's a difference between the car and the driver, and it was almost like, you know, you could see, you know, Prabhupada saying that, but if you look at this conversation, you can see the identification is so strong. It's almost like it's one homogenous unit, the driver and the car, right? Prabhupada tried to give so many different ways to help him understand. What happens if the driver is not in the car? What will the car do? You know, he just, so many different things, he couldn't get it. And Prabhupada was so tolerant. As fire, although situated in wood, is perceived to be different from the wood, as air, although situated within the mouth and nostrils, is perceived to be separate, and as the sky, although all-pervading, never mixes with anything, so the living entity, although now encaged within the material body, of which it is the source, is separate from it. So, these these different points that are being presented here, you'll find that throughout Srila Prabhupada's preaching, they're really the bedrock of a lot of, you know, the amount of times he's stated that, you know, the example. Someone has died, father has died, why are you lamenting? The body is still there. Prabhupada, you know, that's coming from this chapter. You know, the example of the house and the car, so many times Prabhupada used, that's coming from this chapter. And if you look in Prabhupada's preaching, you know, these are step by step foundational understandings to gradually help people to understand the nature of the soul. So sometimes, you know, we speak to people, it's very fashionable for people to accept that you've got a soul. So, you know, if you say to people these days, do you believe in the soul? Oh yeah, man, you've got to have soul. You know, everyone's got a soul like that. But what it actually means to them, you know, that they really have no concept. You know? And so then what you have to consider, do they actually understand, or are they just, yeah, I'm right with you, mate. Soul to soul, you know, I hear you. You know, if you really understand, then you've got to, you know, give these examples and discuss them with them. So you are separate from the body. What's that? And then you see that they've got no understanding. You know, it appears, so it's, they're very simple, you know, points for devotees. But actually, you know, for most people, even as Prabhupada, you know, described Professor Kotovsky from Russia, the Indologist from, you know, when he went to Russia and met the Professor Kotovsky, he couldn't understand. Prabhupada tried to explain to him. He just couldn't relate to it. No, all these different examples. And he was the professor of Indology. So imagine what his students, all the students in Russia, so they'd have no concept. So therefore, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, getting people to say that they've got, you know, yes, I agree, that yes, yeah, I've got a soul. Is really actually scientifically helping them to understand. Then if you understand that, of course you understand that the soul is separate, always separate from the body, even though it's within the body. And these examples of the car are very good. So try the car, try the house analogy. And from what I saw with Srila Prabhupada, even though this person, like half an hour, you imagine how long, you know, we'll be finished the chapter in half an hour. Prabhupada didn't budge. He showed no intolerance to this person. He just kept helping him again and again from every angle of vision just to try and understand. And he didn't go past his point. What's the use of talking about Krishna? What's the use of talking about religion? What's the use of talking about so many different things if a person can't understand that the soul, the self, is separate from the body? Why go any further? So Prabhupada, you know, that was his preaching tactic. You know, until they understand one thing, it was like, you know, if he spoke to Cardinal Danilou in Paris, and the Cardinal wanted to, you know, Prabhupada was asking why, you know, about the question of meat eating, and explaining that the cow is the mother. He couldn't understand that either. But anyway, you know, Prabhupada tried to explain it to him, but, you know, the Cardinal got a bit, you know, a little ill-tempered, and, you know, let us talk something more, you know, there's a God and love, you know, like this. And the Prabhupada wouldn't, because, you know, he understood that, what is the point? How can we talk, you know, we have a saying, how can you talk about love when you've got, you know, meat in your beard? So, you know, he wouldn't. So they're very good. These are extremely important preaching principles, you know, these verses. When you understand each one, you know, properly. So,
Prabhu.
Yes.
But Hiranyakashipu, he talked so much about it, but he did, what did he do after that? So, how can a person then who can talk such philosophy?
That's what we were saying the last time we were here, that, you know, the difference, therefore, between, you know, a devotee and a demoniac person is that a demoniac person may speak the philosophy even properly, but they're only interested in speaking it or not speaking it is how they're going to benefit in the long run. Now here, you know, basically Hiranyakashipu doesn't want anyone deserting him. You know, he's about to embark on a war with Vishnu, and he wants all his relatives and their allies, you know, and their weapons and his friends to fight that war with him. So, you know, he's speaking this philosophy to appease everyone. He's got a mission to do. He doesn't want anyone sobbing in the corner and they're not able to go out and attack Vishnu and do it. So, you know, for his own purposes, he wants to, you know, pacify them. And this philosophy, if you understand it, it does pacify you, and then you're ready for action. So what are we going to do now? You know, a knowledgeable one. Yes, let's kill Vishnu.
My question is, why didn't it cause a change in his heart when he has got so much knowledge? Why?
Well, the change of heart, you know, it comes as a result of God consciousness. Surrender. Bhakti.
So he had knowledge but no bhakti.
Yeah. And as I gave a summary at the beginning of the class, some people were here, some weren't, but that, you know,
the difference is that they follow the instructions and the demons, they do not follow the instructions of the Lord.
Yes, but we discussed that, and that the, you know, a materialistic person may be able to even come to this point of understanding the Shastric understanding of the soul, but without bhakti, there's no question of understanding God. And therefore, he still has a very materialistic understanding of God. And therefore, he still, you know, he thinks, therefore, if he gets rid of that material manifestation of God, which temporarily appears, that leaves him as the supreme being in the universe. So, although they can speak this, they can't speak philosophy properly about the personality of Godhead. They will only come to an impersonal view, which leaves them, you know, to think that they can, you know, they're as good as God or equal to. Yeah, what, the knowledge, you know, philosophical knowledge tends to sink in more when a person is in a mood to hear it. So Yamaraj, one, he appeared in the form of a young boy, you know, and he knew that that would, you know, attract them. That here's a young boy speaking philosophy. What is he saying? You know, this is really good. So it would get them in. And of course, when, otherwise they may not have, you know, allowed someone to even begin speaking. And then hearing the philosophy of the soul, that the person, they're lamenting the person is dead. And then they're thinking, someone tells them, no, he's still there. He's eternal. He's not dead. It's actually very consoling for someone. Whether you don't believe in the soul, or, you know, you're confused, you know, it's very consoling. You know, I've done many memorials, and, you know, Shastrically it's recommended that you speak some verses from Bhagavad Gita to console them. For a lot of persons who are attached to the Karmakanda, they like to read from the Garuda Purana. The Garuda Purana has a lot of description, not so much of the soul, but of the different types of punishments one goes to for sinful reactions and what have you. It tends to sober people up. But the Bhagavad Gita does has some nice descriptions of the soul. And it's very consoling. And I've seen, I remember I went to a university, you know, there were some students died. And I went there, and the Indian, this is here in Melbourne, the Indian community turned out there, you know, none of them devoted, except one. There was Vinod. He went up north now. He, small guy, used to do computing. He married that, she was like Russian, tall, fair girl. Manoj? Yeah. He organised it for me, so he got me to go there. And when I went in, I mean, there was, might have been 100, 200 people in that hall. The mood there was so, you know, the mother was in the front and she was just bawling her eyes out loudly. And all the women around were just bawling their eyes out. They were inconsolable. People couldn't approach them. They were like, you know, almost hyperventilating. And then the rest of the audience were just like, you know, seeing the mother and the relatives. I started speaking the Bhagavad Gita, you know, paraphrasing, and also verses from Ishapanishad, which is... And, you know, within 10 minutes, the whole hall transformed, and I was looking at the mother, and she's sitting there, and she had this smile. And the whole audience, they just become, their whole mood just completely changed, you know. I saw that part. They weren't like, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of Indian people go to university, not necessarily religious, you know. These days, students, you know, they get into all sorts of things. But it changed everyone like that. So it is very consoling. So that's what he is doing. When you hear that the person you think has died is actually may still be somewhere, that's good news. Oh, how, you know. Well, even the impersonalist can speak, you know, if they're just quoting Shastra, you know, then they can speak the knowledge, you know, they can quote Ishapanishad, they can quote Bhagavad Gita, you know, like that, the knowledge of the soul. So,
like Prabhupada says that hearing the chanting, even from a non-devotee, is like taking poison from a snake. So then the preaching here, from a person who's not a being, what effect does that? I think that's what Prabhupada says.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, therefore, you see, you know, I mean, you know, he's not trying to make devotees out of them. You know, so they all remain demons. But they become consoled. But, you know, there's a big difference. If a devotee reads the same passage, people may be inclined to become a devotee. That's really, as we, you know, that was described here. You see the difference between what Prabhupada was saying and the purport. You know, in verse 41, in the purport is saying that, you know, one has to accept the body according to the laws of nature and one's karma. Right? So anyone can speak that. A lot of people believe in karma, even if they're not even religious at all. It doesn't matter whether you're a demon or a devotee, you know, or in between, people believe in karma. And that the material energy is giving you this particular, you know, body. Now, so people accept that. What to do about it, they don't know. But this is where, you know, the Gita, it describes five things. It describes all these things, how you get your body according to higher, you know, powers, which also Hiranyakashipu is saying. Yamaraj and, you know, what have you. You get a particular type of body according to your karma. What to do about it? The Gita says that you can change your karma by bhakti and surrendering to the Lord, and that will free you from your karma. So that's how a devotee would approach the same, you know, taking that opportunity, which I did, you know, in that, where that, you know, university. Then I mentioned these things. And I mentioned that, you know, that's, we are praying to Krishna to intervene in his destiny. So, you know, when a devotee consoles an audience where there's a death, they console them, but they also take the opportunity to help them to understand how they can remedy it. Because otherwise they're still unconsoled, because, you know, really they're thinking, well, how do we fix this, because I'm going to go through this. So that's truly consoling, when you actually explain what has happened and then you explain how you can avoid your karma. So that's how, but that's not what Hiranyakashipu is doing. He's just consoling them, but he's not going to go to the next point and start preaching the Bhagavad Gita, surrender to Krishna, to Vishnu, like that. Actually, what he, as I said, what he wants to do is he wants to console them so they surrender to him. Let's go and kill Vishnu. <You know. laughs> So, you know, I guess, you know, in the minds of a powerful person, they feel that their karma is so powerful that, you know, they're somehow, you know, this is the interesting part, isn't it, that here where he's speaking how, according to higher authorities, you know, which is allocating your karma, a person will die or not die. That is providence, and that is happening to everyone. So he's in the same situation, that according to higher authorities, he will die. Will not die, but what he wants to do is to break that system where he becomes the highest authority, that there is no one above him. That's his mentality, you know, that there's a system in place, but he wants to override that, you know. So he's preaching about the system. This is the system that everyone is in, including the relatives of his dead brother. You're in this system, you're in this system, so why lament this? But his plan is, I will break that system. You know, I will rise above it. So, you know, that is the difference in the mentality there. He's not expecting them. He's not expecting the grieving wives and the children of his dead brother to break that system. You're in this system, this is how it works. But I'm going to break. And which is like the scientists, isn't it? They also, you know, they'll admit, you know, there are the ways this world works. You get old, you get die, you get a body, you know, like that. Happens to everyone, like that. Let's be scientific about this. Death is part of life. but they're trying to break the system. They're acknowledging there's higher powers that will destroy them, but they're trying to override that while preaching to everyone that this is just a part of life. So we shouldn't be surprised at Hiranyakashipu, because the scientists do exactly the same thing. They're not asking the layman that, you know, you somehow break this system for me. They think they're going to do it. You just accept, but I'm going to break it. I'm the scientist. And Hiranyakashipu, you will accept, but I'm going to break it. It's that mentality. Is that your question? So that, you know, that's what we saw, you know, in that purport, text 41, how a devotee takes this philosophy. And these are the, you know, this is what we see from Prabhupada's purports. He explains from the just the point of view that's been presented, but he always, at every stage, explains the positive alternative or the highest alternative. Even, you know, in this verse, you see that we're talking about the concept that the soul is different from the body. So then he just goes a little further, just in case you want to know. Text number 43, in the purport he says that as fire appears separate from wood, and as the air flowing through the nostrils and mouth of the body appears separate from the body, so the Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, appears separate from the living being, but is actually separate and not separate simultaneously. This is the philosophy of Chincha Beda Beda Tattva, propounded by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So here's an example of what Prabhupada does, that if someone reads this and they can accept, they get a breakthrough. Ah, I'm different from the body. I thought it was just all one. But we're sort of, I'm connected and unconnected at the same time. So Prabhupada's taken, well, since you've understood that, apply the same to the Supreme Lord and the living entity. While you're in the mood for understanding that, understand that it exists on the spiritual plane. Because you know, that is the you know, this oneness and difference. So Prabhupada purports are like that, explain the situation and then take the example, take the opportunity. While you're thinking those terms, let me give you something more that needs to be understood, and this is the time to do it. So then Prabhupada explains that according to the reactions of karma, the living entity appears separate from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but actually he is very intimately related with the Lord. Consequently, even though we now seem neglected by the Lord, he is actually always alert to our activities. Under all circumstances, therefore, we should simply depend on the supremacy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and thus revive our intimate relationship with him. We must depend upon the authority and control of the Personality of Godhead. So you see there that Hiranyakashipu, he doesn't want to be under the laws of karma. So, but he's not going to think, oh, let me be friendly with the controller of karma. It's seen because he's a demon. Let me kill the controller of karma and control him like that. But, you know, we learn from the scriptures that there's no need for that. That, you know, there's an intimate relationship with the Supreme Lord. He's not our enemy. So, you know, from Hiranyakashipu's point of view, you know, there's so many things that I want to do, and somehow there are things, you know, above me within this universe, Vishnu, you know, that seem to go against what I want. So therefore, somehow, you know, this higher authority is neglecting my will. you know, my desires, what I want. So in the way that Hiranyakashipu is thinking, we also think like that. Prabhupada is saying, no, don't think like that. You can think that, you know, we've got the karma by our own activities, but then if we actually turn to the Supreme Lord, that karma can be nullified and we can have this very close, intimate relationship where, you know, those obstructions we're feeling disappear. Yamaraj continued, O lamenters, you are all fools. The person named Suyagya, for whom you lament, is still lying before you and has not gone anywhere. Then what is the cause for your lamentation? Previously, he heard you and replied to you, but now, not finding him, you are lamenting. This is contradictory behaviour, for you have never actually seen the person within the body who heard you and replied. There is no need for your lamentation, for the body you have always seen is lying here. So they're lamenting. The person who always replied to us, we cannot see him anymore. But they've never seen him. But the body that they've always seen is still there. And Prabhupada uses that so often. The contradictory statement that it's there. And Prabhupada's point in presenting that is very simple. Therefore, you should understand that the person is different from the body. That is the soul. Prabhupada says in his purport, even a common man can understand that after death a person is gone. Although the body is still there, a dead man's relatives lament that the person has gone away. For a common man sees the body but cannot see the soul. Therefore, in effect, the common man concludes that actually the spirit soul was different from the body and has now gone away. Thus, even a common man coming to his senses can know that the real person who was within the body and was hearing and replying was never seen, for that which was never seen, what is the need for lamentation? So, as Prabhupada points out, Prabhupada used this example for the common man in his preaching. Because, as it's stated even in his purport, actually a common man can understand these factors. And especially when there is a death, people are in the mood to hear because they want to be consoled. And when you speak things that this philosophy is very consoling, and therefore they want to hear it, and at that time they can understand it. And a devotee takes an opportunity to promote the Gita and the extra message of the Gita, that they can rectify this whole cycle of birth and death by bhakti. In the body, the most important substance is the life air, but that also is neither the listener nor the speaker. Beyond even the life air, the soul also can do nothing, for the super soul is actually the director in cooperation with the individual soul. The super soul conducting the activities of the body is different from the body and living force. Important verses from the Gita, Prabhupada quoting, I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Now, before that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, there's the verse also, Aham Vaishvanado that I am also seated within all living entities as the fire of digestion and as the life airs. Because therefore people do the first grains ceremony. Worshipping the Lord when offering the first grains, there should be an adjustment in their consciousness that generally people think, you know, why do I need God? Why do I need to be so religious? If I feed, you know, we're wealthy, we're intelligent, well-educated, if I, you know, beautiful house, if I feed the child really nice, the child will grow up to be healthy and happy and strong, and they'll be very successful in life. But the then you bring it back to, but if the child, despite all your wealth and good food, if the child can't digest the food, then all your facility, including the food, has no value. And therefore, and who is regulating that fire? You know, do you get up and light the pilot light and stoke the fire? No. Is the baby doing that? No. So who is doing it? Someone else. Ah, that is God. So ultimately it brings it back to the point that you are dependent on God. So, you know, ultimately the super soul is really maintaining the body, and that's why we do those first grading ceremonies. Those who do that, they acknowledge that apart from everything they have, actually without the mercy of the Lord, you know, still we cannot be independent of that. And the Lord appreciates that. So you see in the 13th chapter of the Gita, Krishna says in verse number 13:3, O Sona Bharat, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies, and to understand this body and its owner is called knowledge, that is my opinion. So there's the soul and the super soul. That is knowledge. That is the teaching of the Vedas. And it's the super soul actually maintaining the body. A higher force than the life is, and a higher force even than the soul. And again, understanding that is quite important. That shows our dependence on Vishnu. The five material elements, the ten senses and the mind all combine to form the various parts of the gross and subtle body. The living entity comes in contact with his material bodies, whether high or low, and later gives them up by his personal prowess. This strength can be perceived in the living entity's personal power to possess different types of bodies. Prabhupada mentions that by superior knowledge received, you know, from the spiritual master, from the right source, he can give up his conditioned life in a material body and return home back to Godhead. However, if he wants to keep himself in the darkness of this material world, he can do so. It depends very much upon who he worships as to which body he will take. If he worships the demigods, you know, the ghosts and spirits, or the ancestors, etc., he will go to them. If he worships Vishnu, he will go to him, Krishna. But as it's described here, that he can make this choice by his personal prowess, but that means he has to do that in conjunction with a higher authority. to get a particular type of body. Not independently. As long as the spirit soul is covered by the subtle body, consisting of the mind, intelligence and false ego. So, you know, ultimately we see that Hiranyakashipu, he wants to be the controller of all these things, not Vishnu. You know, that's where all this is heading. Ultimately everyone will worship him and he'll be in charge of all the, you know, departments of the universe. So the soul can choose his destination by coming to a certain level of knowledge and consciousness, etc., and taking shelter of a higher authority. So that's his ability to do that. And ultimately, Hiranyakashipu wants to be that highest authority. As long as the spirit soul is covered by the subtle body consisting of the mind, intelligence, and false ego, he is bound to the results of his fruitive activities. Because of this covering, the spirit soul is connected with the material energy and must accordingly suffer material conditions and reversals continually, life after life. It is fruitless to see and talk of the material modes of nature and their result in so-called happiness and distress as if they were factual. When the mind wanders during a day and a man begins to think himself extremely important, or when he, so it's interesting how Hiranyakashipu is, you know, speaking this philosophy because he's the one thinking himself more important than anyone. So that, you know, that's one of the interesting things about this whole chapter is you remember who's speaking it, and it all comes back to how he can speak these things and keep a straight face.
This is spoken by the Maharaja.
Yeah, yes, but Hiranyakashipu is telling the story as evidence of what he just, of the philosophy he's speaking. When the mind wanders during the day and a man begins to think himself extremely important, or when he dreams at night and sees a beautiful woman enjoying with him, these are merely false dreams. Similarly, the happiness and distress caused by the material senses should be understood to be meaningless. Now, of course, how a devotee applies this is that take shelter of Hrishikesh and derive transcendental pleasure. You know, rise above the material concoction of happiness on the material platform.
And we also can apply to think whether we are walking our talks.
Now,
sometimes very often we talk but we don't do the things.
Yes, that's what Hiranyakashipu is.
We don't even notice.
So Hiranyakashipu is doing a similar thing. So he seems to understand that he's within this whole universe which operates in this way, but his plan is ultimately he's going to somehow override this. And challenge the whole system. So he has, you know, it would appear that he's, you know, quite happy to keep others within this system. That, you know, this is the way this universe works. Maybe this is the way it always will work, but not for me, because I've got other plans. He's certainly not expecting everyone to challenge the, you know, all the higher powers of the universe. Those who have full knowledge of self-realization, who know very well that the spirit soul is eternal whereas the body is perishable, are not overwhelmed by lamentation. But persons who lack knowledge of self-realization certainly lament. Therefore, it is difficult to educate a person in illusion. Now, we know that Hiranyakasipu, although he's speaking, you know, in terms of this temporary happiness, and, you know, the soul in illusion, in material consciousness, we know that when he took benedictions from Brahma, you know, his plan was that he would be immortal. You know, that he's not going to be somehow stuck within, you know, I'm happy now because I have my, you know, situation, but then when I die, it'll all be finished. I'm not going to be in that situation of duality because I'll be immortal. What I set up for me will be permanent because I'll keep living. So, you know, he's speaking like this, that, okay, all of you, everyone's going to be in this situation. This is a way, but not for me. He's personally going to rise above this. So, you know, that was the nature of his prayers, that he would become immortal. So this is the way things are. He's speaking as it is, but he also, within his mind, he wants to rise above this. He thinks he can do that. Those who have full knowledge of self-realization, who know very well that the spirit soul is eternal. Read that one, yeah. So there was once, so then he gives this example here, which is part of Yamaraj's discussion. There was once a hunter who lured birds with food and captured them after spreading a net. He lived as if appointed by death personified as the killer of the birds. But there's another Puranic, now Yamaraj is quoting another Puranic story. While wandering in the forest, the hunter saw a pair of Kalinga birds. Of the two, the female was captivated by the hunter's lure. So Kalinga, I guess there's some sort of pigeon or something. I'm sure, what does it say there? And, O queens of Suyagya, the male Kalinga bird, seeing his wife put into the greatest danger in the grip of providence, became very unhappy. Because of affection, the poor bird, being unable to release her, began to lament for his wife. Alas, how merciless is providence! My wife, unable to be helped by anyone, is in such an awkward position and lamenting for me. What will providence gain by taking away this poor bird? What will be the profit? If unkind providence takes away my wife, who is half my body, why should he not take me also? What is the use of my living with my half of my body, bereaved by the loss of my wife? What shall I gain in this way? The unfortunate baby birds, bereft of their mother, are waiting in the nest for her to feed them. They are still very small and have not yet grown their wings. How shall I be able to maintain them? As Prabhupada points out, that as Yamaraj has explained in his teachings, that although, you know, the birds lamenting that, you know, who will look after the babies, you know, philosophically we've understood that actually by providence, although they're left uncared for, they may not be eaten. Because the personality of Godhead protects one. Even though one may be motherless and fatherless, one can be maintained by the goodwill of the Lord. Otherwise, if the Supreme Lord does not give one protection, one must suffer in spite of the presence of his father and mother. Another example is that sometimes a patient dies in spite of a good physician and good medicine. Thus, without the protection of the Lord, one cannot live with or without parents. Another point in this verse is that fathers and mothers have protective feelings for their children, even in bird and beast society, not to speak of human society. Kali Yuga, however, is so degraded that a father and mother even kill their children in the womb on the plea of their scientific knowledge that within the womb the child has no life. Prestigious medical practitioners give this opinion, and therefore the father and mother of this day kill their children within the womb. How degraded human society has become. Their scientific knowledge is so advanced that they think within the egg and the embryo there is no life. Now these so-called scientists are receiving Nobel Prizes for advancing the theory of chemical evolution. But if chemical combinations are the source of life, why don't the scientists manufacture something like an egg through chemistry and put it in an incubator so that a chicken will come out? What is their answer? There's another, very prevalent statement that Prabhupada has made, to the science. Just make me one egg. He would say, they're all chemists, just make one egg then. Shouldn't be difficult. Scientists, they can do anything. Make one egg, they can't do it. With their scientific knowledge, they're unable to create even an egg. And he repeatedly challenges them on this. Such scientists are described in Bhagavad Gita as Mayaparita Jnana, fools whose real knowledge has been taken away. They're not men of knowledge, but they pose as scientists and philosophers, although their so-called theoretical knowledge cannot produce practical results. See how clever Prabhupada is? He'll take their arguments and use it against them. Take their own weapons off them and beat them with them. Everything is made of chemicals. Oh, okay. Make me one egg. There's no life. Life is not involved. It has nothing to do with the chicken. Life doesn't come from life. It comes from chemicals. Make one egg. You're a scientist. They can do anything. They can send people to the moon. They can do this. They can do that. They cannot do it. And also, not only does he challenge them so simply, right? That's a really simple challenge, isn't it? He's not asking for much, one egg. And yet he's defeated the entire scientific world with one challenge. Make me one egg. It's too, they cannot. All of their science, all defeated. Why? Something else. There's a life factor. And he's also pointing out that not only is it easy to defeat them because they're such nonsense, they're claiming they're so advanced, even the animals look after their children. They're claiming that it's just chemicals. They're killing. Because it's all chemicals, then we can kill the child within the womb. If it's all chemicals, then make one egg. And because you can't do it, means it's not all chemicals, means that life is coming from life, therefore you have no right to abort the child. That's his argument. In other words, I killed the child within the womb because it's just chemicals. And that I have scientific proof. You put your money where your mouth is. You make me one egg. Because life is coming from life. You say it's coming from chemicals. You make that egg. Make one egg and prove your statement. Now, I cannot prove it, but I will in the future. Well, in the meantime, stop killing. I'm killing billions of babies on the scientific evidence, very scientific, we have no proof to back it up, but it's scientific, that they're just chemicals. Oh, you prove that, you make one egg. No, we cannot prove that. Because there seems to be something else involved, but we don't know what. Then stop killing in the meantime. Oh, no, that we won't do. We'll get the proof. The proof is coming. In the meantime, we'll keep killing. These are illustrious leaders. Because of the loss of his because of the loss of his wife, the Kalinga bird lamented with tears in his eyes. Meanwhile, following the dictations of mature time, the hunter, who was very carefully hidden in the distance, released his arrow, which pierced the body of the Kalinga bird and killed him. Thus Yamaraj, in the guise of a small boy, told the queens, "You are so foolish that you lament but do not see your own death. Afflicted by the poor fund of knowledge, you do not know that even if you lament for your dead husband for hundreds of years, you will never get him back alive. And in the meantime, your lives will be finished." Prabhupada says in the purport, "This is the most wonderful thing in the world. Right? Hundreds and thousands of living entities meet death at every moment, but a foolish living being nonetheless thinks himself deathless and does not prepare for death." Again, back to the scientists. So-called scientists, he doesn't really accept them as scientists. So-called. The pretense of scientists, leaders, philosophers, all rascals. I'm not saying. Prabhupada's saying. Krishna said it in the Gita. And Prabhupada said it. I'm not saying it. But he says, so-called scientists are making various plans by which living entities in the future can live forever. But while they are thus pursuing such scientific knowledge, Yamaraj, in due course of time, will take them away from the business of so-called research. So, you see, you know, the potency of Srila Prabhupada's, you know, how he takes his Bhagavad Gita as a real powerful preaching tool and literally just smashes to pieces the nonsense of everyone in this world, all the so-called knowledgeable people and the scientists and the leaders and the religionists and everyone, all of them, from top to bottom, all, you know, cut down to just fools and rascals. Well, the, you know, Prabhupada's expert preacher, how he takes these arguments and, you know, puts them, you know, what is the practical application of this? Practical application of this is we should take this Bhagavad Gita and stop people from having abortions. We should stop people from, you know, killing the cow especially. We should stop people from, you know, wars in the name that basically, you know, it's just, they're just like some cancerous growth on the earth, you know, what, you know, ethnic cleansing and so many things. You know, all these violent, nasty behaviour on this planet come back to the fact that people cannot understand the proper truth of the matter, and if they explain the proper truth of the matter, all of these nonsense activities would stop. This is the application of the, you know, the Bhagavad Gita. And there it rests in our hands, you know, to not just to read it and be shy that somehow, oh, I couldn't speak this in society or I couldn't tell this to him. You know, we actually have to, you know, really take the Bhagavad Gita, fully understand it, understand its application through Prabhupada's wonderful preaching and his purports, and then apply the same and literally, you know, make a revolution, you know, in this impious world. You know, this Bhagavad Gita is meant for that. It's meant for a revolution, which is coming. So, we've got a couple of verses. I have no idea what the time is. 4:58, we've got 2 minutes. I think we'll probably just do it, yes. All right. Thus, Hiranyakashipu said, while Yamaraj in the form of a small boy was instructing all the relatives surrounding the dead body of Suyagya, everyone was struck with wonder by his philosophical words. They could understand that everything material is temporary and not continuing to exist. After instructing all the foolish relatives of Suyagya, Yamaraj in the form of a boy disappeared from their vision. Then the relatives of King Suyagya performed the ritualistic funeral ceremonies. Therefore, none of you should be aggrieved for the loss of the body, whether your own or those of others. Only in ignorance does one make bodily distinctions, thinking, who am I, who are the others, what is mine, what is for others. So we see down here that after the Sanskrit by Madhvacharya, that the purport is that as long as we are in the human form of body, our duty is to understand the soul within the body. So that's the main thing we're taking from this. The body is not the self, we're different from the body, and therefore there is no question of friends, enemies or responsibilities in terms of the bodily conception of life. But basically that undermines all the nonsense politics and wars and racism and so many things that go on under the bodily conception of life. If they can understand the soul, all of that stops. Or is curtailed to a significant degree. One should not be very anxious about the body's changing from childhood to boyhood, etc., and then to apparent annihilation. Rather, one should be very seriously concerned about the soul within the body, and how to realize this, release the soul from the material clutches. So that's where an intelligent person comes to. That's the purpose of all this. This material world is temporary, the material body is temporary, I'm not the body, I'm the soul. Then the next thing, I must then turn my attention to releasing the soul from this material clutches. One should surely know that whether one has many friends or many enemies, his friends cannot help him and his enemies cannot do any harm. One should know that he is a spirit soul and that the constitutional position of the soul is unaffected by the changes of the body. In all circumstances, everyone as a spirit soul must be a devotee of Lord Vishnu and should not be concerned with bodily relationships, whether with friends or enemies. One should know that neither we ourselves nor our enemies in the bodily conception of life are ever killed. So, you know, by understanding this philosophy, you really change your whole, you know, attitude to life and what you're doing in this world. That, you know, all your priorities change as a devotee, and you just fix yourself. So I'm just going to be a devotee of the Lord. I'm going to, you know, surrender to Krishna, who's the, you know, supreme manifestation of, you know, Vishnu. Vishnu expands from Krishna, and by that, you know, attain the spiritual realm. Sri Narada Muni continued, Diti, the mother of Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha, heard the instructions of Hiranyakashipu along with her daughter-in-law, Rushabhanu, Hiranyaksha's wife. She then forgot her grief over her son's death and thus engaged her mind and attention and understand the real philosophy of life. Now, last purport, Prabhupada says, when a relative dies, one certainly becomes very much interested in philosophy, but when the funeral ceremony is over, one again becomes attentive to materialism. Even Daitas, who are materialistic persons, sometimes think of philosophy when some relative meets death. The technical term for this attitude of the materialistic person is smasana vairagya, or detachment in a cemetery or a place of cremation. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, four classes of men receive an understanding of spiritual life and God: artha, jigyasu, atati, and jnani. Especially when one is very much distressed by material conditions, one becomes interested in God. Therefore, Kunti Devi said in her prayers to Krishna that she preferred distress to happy mood of life. In the material world, one who is happy forgets God or Krishna. But sometimes if one is actually pious but in distress, he remembers Krishna. Queen Kuntadevi therefore preferred distress because it is an opportunity for remembering Krishna. When Krishna was leaving Kuntadevi for his own country, Kuntadevi regretfully said that she was better off in distress because Krishna was always present. Whereas now the Pandavas were situated in their kingdom, Krishna was going away. For a devotee, distress is an opportunity to remember the Supreme Personality of Godhead constantly. That finishes chapter 2. And next week we will hear chapter 3, Hiranyakashipu's plan to become immortal. And that was his mentality, even though while he was speaking that philosophy. And as we've said, by hearing the Bhagavatam, we actually have to be able to discern that there are the externals in this world. There's also externals within ISKCON. There may be externals within our own behavior, and we have to see, you know, what's going on inside, and that's really seeing. Hare Krishna. Jai. We'll see you all next week. Yeah.